At 93 years old, Joe Rantz sat in his recliner with oxygen tubes nearby, sharing stories from a lifetime. But when he spoke about the boat, not just the physical shell or even his teammates, but something transcendent, tears filled his eyes. That boat had shaped everything. His daughter later showed the visitor an Olympic gold medal once stolen by a squirrel and hidden in their attic. As the conversation ended, Joe insisted, "But not just about me. It has to be about the boat." This wasn't false modesty. Joe understood something profound about human connection, learned through years of brutal training and one unforgettable race in Nazi Germany. His story reveals a timeless truth. Our greatest strength emerges not from fierce independence, but from the courage to trust completely in others. Joe Rantz's childhood was a catalog of abandonment. His mother died when he was 4. His father fled to Canada. His brother left for college. Joe was shipped to Pennsylvania to live with strangers. When his father remarried and reclaimed him, Joe briefly found stability, until his stepmother Thula made her feelings clear. At 15, Joe woke to find his family had vanished in the night, leaving him alone in their half-finished house in Sekum, Washington. Most teenagers would have collapsed. Joe survived. He defended the chicken coop with a homemade club, caught massive Chinook salmon to sell in town, and played banjo for tips. He worked brutal jobs, digging irrigation ditches, splitting fence rails, logging in freezing rain. These years forged extraordinary physical strength and equally extraordinary emotional scars. By the time Joe arrived at the University of Washington in 1933, he carried a simple philosophy: trust no one, depend on yourself, survive. This mindset had kept him alive. It would also nearly destroy his rowing career. The Washington Shell House was a converted airplane hangar where gleaming racing shells hung like sacred relics. Here, 175 young men competed for 9 seats in the freshman boat. Most had never rowed before: city boys, farm boys, lumberjacks with powerful builds. But rowing demanded far more than brute strength. It required mastering what Coach Tom Bowles called 1,001 small things: technical precision, cardiovascular endurance, and mental fortitude that separated champions from quitters. Training was methodical torture. A single 2,000-meter race packed the exertion of 2 consecutive basketball games into 6 brutal minutes. The boys trained in Old Nero, a wide, flat-bottomed barge where coaches scrutinized every movement. One mistake, catching a crab, could jam an oar in the water and catapult a rower into the lake. As October wore on, fewer boys made the climb each day. Joe persevered. Hurting was nothing new. But Coach Al Ulbrichtsen needed more than toughness. He needed young men willing to throw their egos over the side, to pull for each other rather than personal glory. This would prove Joe's greatest challenge. His survival had depended entirely on self-reliance. Learning to trust teammates felt like learning to breathe underwater. George Yeoman Pocock's workshop smelled of cedar and possibility. This English boat builder, who'd crafted shells for Eton before immigrating to America, built engineering masterpieces weighing just 250 pounds, yet supporting 8 200-pound oarsmen. By the 1930s, virtually every major collegiate program rowed in his boats, crafted from Western red cedar, aged and selected for perfect grain alignment. But Pocock's greatest contribution transcended craftsmanship. He understood rowing as life's essential truth. "Once the race starts, there are no timeouts, no substitutions," he told young men. When a crew found their perfect swing, that rare state when 8 individuals moved as one, they experienced something approaching the divine. For Pocock, cedar fibers offered a perfect metaphor. Each fiber, fragile alone, became remarkably strong when properly aligned with others. When Joe struggled in his sophomore year, earning the nickname Mr. Individuality, Pocock invited him to the workshop. "When you really start trusting those other boys," he explained, "you will feel a power at work within you that is far beyond anything you've ever imagined." This philosophy proved transformative, teaching Joe that true strength came not from independence, but from vulnerability and trust. On March 21, 1936, Joe moved to the second varsity boat with Roger Morris, Chuck Day, Johnny White, Stubb McMillan, Shorty Hunt, Gordy Adam, Don Hume, and coxswain Bobby Mock. For the first time, Joe felt he truly belonged. Following Pocock's advice, Joe surrendered entirely to the crew's effort. He followed Hume's stroke flawlessly and passed it back to Shorty in seamless flow. Trust came naturally with these Depression-era boys who'd endured grueling manual labor. They rowed for each other, not themselves. The boat flew, winning practice races by astonishing margins. On March 28th, Ulbrichsen declared them varsity. Their dominance was absolute. In April 1936, they destroyed California at the Pacific Coast Regatta, breaking the course record by 37 seconds. At Poughkeepsie, they swept all three races, establishing Washington as America's premier rowing power. Their victory earned them a spot in the Olympic trials at Princeton, where they defeated the nation's best to become the United States Olympic Eight. When they needed $5,000 for Berlin, Seattle raised it within 2 days. As the SS Manhattan sailed toward Germany, Hitler's regime transformed 325 acres outside Berlin into the Reich's Sportfeld, temporarily removing "Jews not welcome" signs to hide persecution from international visitors. For the Washington crew, this transcended athletic competition. They were rowing for American values against tyranny. Bobby Mach received a shocking letter revealing his Jewish heritage, concealed even from his own children. Atop the Empire State Building, gazing at the Statue of Liberty, Joe understood they would be rowing for a way of life. In Berlin, everything went wrong. Their timing was off, their poles weak, and Don Hume fell seriously ill. In the preliminary heat on August 12, they started poorly and fell to last place. But with 250 meters remaining, Mach called for a power move. The crew found their perfect swing and powered past the British boat in the final 20 strokes, finishing 20 feet ahead and setting a new Olympic record. They had advanced to the final, but the real test was yet to come. The final race on August 14, 1936, began disastrously. Bobby Mach missed the starter signal, leaving the Americans a stroke and a half behind. At 300 meters, Don Hume went pale, mouth open, nearly unconscious. By 800 meters, they'd fallen to dead last as Hitler watched from the balcony. Just as Mach prepared to hand stroke responsibility to Joe, Hume's head snapped up. He locked eyes with Mach and responded. The boys surged from fifth to third at 1,500 meters. With 300 meters left, they pulled even, then edged ahead. Mach lied about the stroke count to push them beyond their limits. They reached an unprecedented 44 strokes per minute as the crowd roared, "Deutschland! Deutschland!" The Americans won by 0.6 seconds over Italy and 1 second over Germany. As the flag rose, Joe found tears in his eyes. The abandoned boy had found his home in the trust of 8 young men who rowed as one. In a world celebrating individual achievement, the boys in the boat remind us that our greatest accomplishments come when we row as one. Joe Rance's journey from abandoned child to Olympic champion was about healing through trust. George Pocock understood. Rowing's greatest lesson isn't about technique or strength. It's about vulnerability and connection. When you surrender your ego to the boat, when you trust completely in your crewmates, you touch something divine. Find your boat. Find people worth trusting. Row together. The strength of the crew isn't determined by its strongest member, but by how completely each person surrenders individual desires for the good of the whole. That's not just how you win races, that's how you win at life.